Aloha and welcome to Our Homes, Ending the Housing Crisis. My name is Stanley Chang, and I'm a state senator in Honolulu, Hawaii. We're here to understand housing more deeply and seek new, innovative solutions from all over the world to the severe housing crisis here. But many of the lessons may also apply to your community, wherever you may be. And now, on with the show. All right, welcome. Good afternoon. I'm pleased to be re-hosting our Homes webinar and podcast series. Our guest today is Tyler Iokepa-Gomes, who serves as deputy to the chair of the Hawaiian Homes Commission in the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, or DHHL. He is the second in command at DHHL. He was raised in Kailua, Oahu, and received his BA in Hawaiian language from UH Manoa and JD and certificate in Native Hawaiian law from the UH Richardson School of Law. He was appointed by Governor Ige to his current position on September 30th, 2019, and subsequently confirmed by the Hawaii State Senate to serve a term ending December 5th, 2022. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Okay, so we understand you have a presentation, so please take it away.
Sure. All right, so what you'll see on the top of all the number pairings is the number of applicants there are for residential land on each of the islands. Beneath that, you'll see the available acreage. The immediate clarity should be, simply put, we don't have enough lands available for residential leases. In fact, we are responsible for the maintenance and control of very large swaths of undevelopable preservation and conservation land, which is unsuitable and probably not appropriate for housing. And so one of the challenges we have to overcome is figuring out how to acquire more land. Another of the challenges we face is an issue of time. The current estimate is that it'll take 182 years to meet demand at our current rate, assuming no one else joins the wait list. We know from a recent study that we did in 2020 that over half of our waitlisters are over the age of 60. And we know that at least 2,000 Native Hawaiians have passed away while waiting on the waiting list. And these are unacceptable figures. These are things that motivate us every day to do the work that we do. But it does put into light the immediacy of trying to solve this problem. And then the final issue that the department regularly faces is an issue of funding. And for context, our budget request for fiscal 22-23 was about $145.9 million. Our actual appropriation for fiscal 21, so this current fiscal year, was $20 million. And we estimate that it would take approximately $4.5 billion to maybe even $6 billion conservatively just to provide infrastructure to develop a lot for every single person on the wait list. And so, you know, this is a massive gap that we need to strategically try to figure out how to fill. There's been no shortage of creative ideas to try and accomplish that, but I think it, what we've been able to do is move that conversation along. So what you're seeing here now is sort of a mapping of the percentage in increase in a few things. At the top of the chart, you'll see the number of applications that have increased from 1976 to present, right? It's a particularly large spike in about 1985, and then it just never stops. And the same is true sort of for the number of leases we've given out in pink. The number here that I think is really important is when we look at the number of authorized positions in the department, the blue line, it never really increases at the rate that everything else does, which should impress upon people that the department has been expected to do a lot and a lot more each and every year after that with a relatively unchanging level of staff, which can be very difficult. This is a similar sort of mapping of the funding we've received in terms of CIP, which is in yellow, and general funds, which is in purple. And you'll see that for many years, there was relatively no change in the amount of money received up until recently, maybe in the last 6-7 years. And so when all of that is looked together in context, you see that we have a very, very large problem that's been met with the challenge of having, you know, a limited amount of staff and a limited amount of funding. One thing that I think people are always interested in is the fact that we do lease out some of our land for commercial purposes. So we've got about 203,000 acres in the inventory. We lease approximately 2,800 of that for general leasing, which are long-term leases. That generates about $15.7 million in annual income for the department, which seems like a lot of money, I think, you know, from the general public's perspective. But when you consider the amount of money we need and how much each project costs, you know, $15 million a year doesn't do enough for the department. And so what I want to focus on is now is some past initiatives that the department has undertaken to sort of help solve this problem, that don't necessarily involve asking for more money or more staff. It just involved a lot of creativity. So one of those things was called the Quiliana Land Awards. Those were awards we made for undeveloped lots. And the idea was that it would provide for lots in a more rural setting with limited infrastructure, meaning just roads. And it would be up to those who accepted leases in those areas to figure the rest out themselves. And there was demand for that. But really it challenged beneficiaries to sort of make the most of a very basic award. Similarly, we also did something called accelerated lot awards, similar to the Quiliana Land Awards, except we committed to providing the infrastructure in the long term. It just involved putting people on the land first, and then the department made a long-term commitment to one day coming back and finishing the infrastructure. We did a survey. The overall satisfaction with the accelerated lot awards program was not particularly high. Third, we've tried something called undivided interest that was done in the 2000s. And essentially, that was different, right? Quiliana Land Awards and accelerated awards gave awards for actual lots. Undivided interest, and that shouldn't say lots, it should say awards, I'm sorry, but undivided interest provided people a paper lease, which basically means they received a lease to unspecified lot that would one day be developed. And what that allowed folks to do was get off of the wait list. An undivided paper lease would be inheritable. You could pass it on to a successor, unlike your place on the wait list. And you would wait until a lot in a certain area was developed, and then your paper lease would be good for a lot there. One of the challenges with undivided interest was we gave out so many of them, it did bring the numbers down. However, we weren't prepared to develop all of those lots right away. To this day, we are still developing to make up for all of those undivided interest leases that were given out almost 20 years ago. Another thing that we've tried is Kupuna rental housing. We have a Kupuna rental housing project in Waimanalo, which is in high demand and filled. And I think that that's been particularly successful and sort of inspires the department to think about other ways to provide housing to Native Hawaiians that don't necessarily involve them getting the 99-year lease on our lands, which as a term of the act, but it does address the larger problem, which is how do we house our people? And the same is true of Ho'olimalima, which was a rent-to-own project here in Kapolei, which essentially gave people the opportunity to rent for 15 years. And then at the end of the 15 years, they could own, they could mortgage and own the remainder of the project. And it sort of gave people who maybe weren't ready with the down payment the opportunity to save and prepare over that 15-year period and eventually get into housing. And so all of these things, I think, are the product of a department that, like I mentioned, was faced with a lot of challenges, but came up with a lot of creative ways to try and address the problem. And I think that that's the spirit of what we need to embrace in terms of solving Hawaii's affordable housing crisis. The benefit is the Department of Hawaiian Homelands has 100 years of experience trying to solve these problems. And so, you know, at the risk of history being cyclical, you know, the state, the rest of the state, you know, and all others who are involved in sort of addressing the housing crisis and proposing solutions, you know, the department should really be seen as an example of what's been tried and what's worked and what hasn't in terms of sort of meeting the need. I wanted to go over some statistics that I think people will find interesting about the department. You know, what I hope people get out of, you know, that last slide is, while yes, we are often measured by how rapidly we're solving the issue of our wait list, you know, there are ways to provide assistance that don't necessarily impact the wait list, but do impact in Hawaiian lives. And so as a result, I wanted to provide some insight into, you know, who are the people on our wait list and what is a picture of what that person looks like. So we did a beneficiary study at the end of 2020 that was released. Of that study, we were able to sort of estimate that of the 28,000 folks on the waitlist, about 58% want a residential lease. Now, under the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, you can accept a residential, you can accept an agricultural lease, or you can not accept, but apply for an agricultural lease, or you can apply for a pastoral lease. Residential has been and continues to be the product in highest demand. This is true since the 80s, and it's also true of why the department has particularly focused on providing residential lots. When surveyed, 53.9% of our applicants on the waitlist indicated they wanted a move-in ready single family, what we call a turnkey house, which is, you know, the product that we primarily focus on. I think for a lot of people, it's a metric that they can readily understand and picture. So we are often looked at as a housing department, which isn't necessarily true, but it is, you know, the one thing that I think the majority of our families would like. Their second choice is something, we call it a vacant lot, but essentially what it is an undeveloped lot with infrastructure in place. And that gives the beneficiary the flexibility and the ability to build what they want on the lot, knowing that water, sewer, and electric are already in place and the department has put that there. That typically comes out of the department's pocket anyway when we develop. Our average is about $150,000 out of the department's pocket to put in water, sewer, and electric. When we look at the applicant list, almost 85% want three or more bedrooms. And that is significant not only because of the nature of, I want to say, multi-generational living and the size of, you know, families, but it's also indicative of what the cost is to develop that. I mean, the reality of developing, you know, let's say 15,000 three-bedroom homes, three or more bedroom homes, that can be very costly. That's not necessarily in a price point that's attainable for everybody, but it represents the majority of the demand. And then in terms of household size, 67% of our applicants have between one and four people in their household. Some additional statistics. Interestingly, 48% of those on our waitlist are already homeowners. And when you talk to them, many are on the waitlist because they are trying to benefit their families. They're trying to use their qualifications so that they can pass it on to a successor who's usually a child or a grandchild, someone of 25% Native Hawaiian or greater. And when you think about it like that, you know, that's someone who is currently waiting for a house in Hawaii anyway. If the department can assist in that, you know, we are freeing up the demand for fee simple inventory by being able to provide these lots. 35% of our households make an annual income of $50,000 to $99,000 a year. This is the largest grouping out of all the income brackets. That's not a lot of money. I think we can be candidly honest about that, which sort of makes the importance of this work that much more real, I guess, is knowing that these are families who are in desperate need of affordable housing solutions. These are some statistics about those who remain on the waitlist. 48.6% of the waitlist have received an award and turned it down more than three times. Of those who turned it down at least once, so not the three or more, but anyone who's turned down an award, almost 35% of them turned down the award because they weren't ready to accept it. And that's interesting to point out because it didn't mean they weren't ready financially. We had a separate category for those who were financially unable to qualify. These are folks who just felt that they weren't in a place to accept. Almost 51% of the waitlist, those who have turned down an award, turned it down due to the location. And the only way we're going to solve that problem, like I said, is acquiring more land and money to develop in more favorable areas. But when we keep this in perspective and folks sort of grade the department on the length of the wait list and grade the department on how long folks have been on the wait list, it's important to put it back into perspective and say that there are a lot of multifaceted challenges to meeting the needs of Native Hawaiians. And it's not always as simple as there are 28,000 people waiting in line, you're not doing anything about it. So these are some current and future initiatives that we are contemplating that I think help to address this crisis from DHL's perspective. We're still working on that Kuleana Land Award program. We have additional sites for Kuleana Land Awards, which again, just reminding folks, provides people undeveloped raw land to do with as they please, which there is demand for. I mean, it's not the majority of our beneficiaries. They don't want that, but there are folks who do. We are continuing. We just awarded 60 new rent with option to purchase lots in Kona 2 weekends ago. And it's a really exciting opportunity just to see people come in who, again, aren't ready to do maybe a down payment on a house, but can absolutely afford to rent a property for 15 years with the option to own that property after that 15 years is up. Double skipped, but many people know that we're working on condominium rentals in the urban core of Honolulu in Mo'ili'ili. And what was great about that project is the developer came in and the developer will bear 100% of the cost. So it doesn't cost the department anything in that particular project that's on the site of the former Bolodrome to do more rentals. And we know that there are beneficiaries on the list who are interested in condominium living, who are interested in renting. And so again, maybe not addressing the wait list, but re-metricizing what the department can do to sort of provide housing units. And then a recent initiative that the commission approved is a fee simple down payment assistance program, which is still in the works of figuring out the details, but I'm excited to talk about it in the sense that this is a very creative way for us to assist beneficiaries. And the commission is interested in, okay, if someone is on the wait list and they are ready to buy a home in the fee simple world, so off of Hawaiian homelands, any unit, what can the department do to provide assistance in the down payment? And you know, what does that look like for the department? Is there a first right of refusal so that the property comes into department inventory? Should the beneficiary choose to sell? These are all things that have to be worked out. Nothing set in stone, but I think that sort of creativity that the commission is expressing in figuring out how to provide additional routes to residency for Native Hawaiians is incredibly important. And so this is the end of, I guess, the formal slideshow that I prepared. And Senator Chang, happy to answer any questions you might have or folks watching have. Thank you for that opportunity to share all of that.
Thank you so much, Tyler. Participants, if you would like to ask a question, you can type it into the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen. I'll begin with a question about a proposal that you brought to the state legislative session this year, which was to allow for casino gambling to generate revenue to help pay for housing development. Can you tell us about that initiative, the current status, and why you thought it would have been a good idea?
Sure. The casino bill, we'll start with the status. The casino bill for this legislative session is, dead is the best word for it, which means that it didn't pass out of any of its legislative committees. We were fortunate enough to have a hearing in the Senate. And, you know, the casino bill was proposed as one way to sort of fill the funding gap. And I wouldn't say that we were immediately wed to the idea of it passing this session. We knew it would provoke a lot of discussion. We knew it provoke a lot of emotions as the discussion around casino gaming has done in Hawaii for the last 20 years. But we had to try something. And I think the one benefit of going through the process of proposing the casino bill was that, you know, some of the slides that I used came from our casino presentation that we had done repeatedly. What that allowed us to do is get Native Hawaiians and even non-Native Hawaiians, a lot of our advocates and our allies, to a point of like functional fluency to be able to talk about the challenges facing the department. That's a huge win because, for example, this legislative session, it looks like our budget will be significantly higher than it has been in years past. And I'd say that is a win for us. We've managed to successfully convey how deep the department's need is as a result of the discussion around the casino. And I think we're seeing people respond to that. And I mean, just briefly, not to belabor the casino itself, but casinos have proven to be very lucrative for a lot of Indigenous people, not just in this country, but across the world in terms of generating revenue. The state is currently challenged with the number of revenue streams that it does have. I'm not saying it's the only option. I'm not saying it has to be the solution, but it definitely was an idea. And I think the benefit of that was I think we got a really healthy discussion out of it.
Thank you so much for the update. Okay, we'll start with a question from the audience. Affordable low-income rental housing seems to be at least a temporary solution to the housing issue. However, the blood quantum requirement that your department has of 50% Native Hawaiian blood is a disincentive to potential housing investors, as there is no guarantee that a housing project can maintain an occupancy level to sustain operational expenses. Is it possible to adjust the mandate to provide a preference for blood quantum? And if occupancy drops to say 90%, then open to the general public and future blood quantum applicants would go to the top of the wait list for a rental project like that?
That's a sort of an interesting challenge in that, you know, we've heard the concern in the past that potentially we wouldn't be able to meet occupancy. I think in the context of Bolodrome at this point, I think the developer feels confident that shouldn't be an issue. However, I think the bigger point to be made here is that under the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, I don't think we could do that, right? Any use of our lands for housing purposes, I think, calls for us to follow the mandate of blood quantum. And I think it would be a disservice to those on the wait list who have been waiting for decades. It would be probably disingenuous for those who have passed away on the wait list for us to be using land to house those who are not fulfilling the minimum criteria as expressed in the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act. I think we have to be really sensitive to the fact that if this land is going to be used for housing, we've got to not just comply with the act in spirit, but we should do it in good faith as well.
Here's another question from the audience. You mentioned in your slide earlier that many Native Hawaiians had received awards but turned them down because they were waiting for a more favorable location. What are those areas that you think Native Hawaiians would like the housing to be in?
I think for a lot of families, when they say that they don't like the location, oftentimes it's not, for some, it's not in the, we have a lot of residents, say, for in Waimanalo example, who may not live on homestead in Waimanalo, but they know that there are currently homesteads there. So they're waiting in the hopes that maybe perhaps that one day there'll be more opportunities in Waimanalo. I think that's a lot of it, is you see people wanting to stay close to, you know, their homes, their families. Particularly, there are many folks who are interested in moving all the way across the island in whatever direction that might be. And so I think when they say that, you know, it's not the right location, that's a huge part of it. But, you know, we've got to keep moving forward. And so, you know, we'll continue to develop projects. Oahu is the hardest. That is where we have the least amount of lands available for residential. So the only way to solve that problem is, you know, in the long term, we're going to have to acquire more land, whether that's by exchange or by purchase. But in acquiring new land, that's one way for us to maybe find more desirable land. There are tons of areas in this island that do not have homesteads, let alone large Native Hawaiian populations. I, for one, would love to see, you know, larger. I grew up in Kailua. I would love to see more Native Hawaiians in Kailua. I would love to see Native Hawaiians in a lot of areas where they're not predominantly represented. And I think that's a huge opportunity there, which sort of brings me to my pitch, if you will, which is, I think, you know, solving one, okay, one, the responsibility of fulfilling the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act is not the Department of Hawaiian Homeland's responsibility, right? We're just the arm responsible for doing it. It's the responsibility to the state of Hawaii. And I think that means that everyone needs to embrace that kuleana, that responsibility equally in order to help us solve it. And so I think if we're gonna continually have a discussion about how do we solve the affordable housing crisis, I think dedicating as many resources as possible to assisting the department in solving the waitlist necessarily frees up inventory in the fee simple market and creates more units available for those who don't qualify under the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act. And so I would love to see every single player in the affordable housing discussion come to the table, and maybe we make it a dedicated challenge to divert all resources for developing affordable housing to the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, whether it's, you know, other agencies challenging themselves to assess lands that might be more suitable for us to develop for housing, and maybe we have land that's more suitable for them to maintain. That's one way to do it. You know, landowners in the state who are interested in helping solve this problem, maybe approaching the department with proposals. You know, any way we can get land, hands, and money to this problem, to this, I think it benefits everyone. So I would love to see, you know, everybody jump in on the Hawaiian Homelands challenge. And if we can eliminate the wait list, I think that will have broad and far-reaching effects that impact all residents for the state of Hawaii.
So that's a really interesting point. And it's one that others have also argued in public, that DHHL should come first in terms of resources. You've already identified in your presentation dollars, $4.5 billion for infrastructure alone. You've also identified land, especially on the most populous island of Oahu, as something that your department needs. If the governor were to ask you, Tyler, come up with a plan to bring the waitlist down to zero, what would be on that wait list? Would it just simply be a certain number of acres on Oahu plus $4.5 billion?
No, it's not. I think we need additional capacity to do. So first of all, with the way that our budget works, like when we identify projects that have to be done, our projects take approximately 6 years from planning to keys in the door to completion. A lot of that has to do with the funding doesn't come in steady streams. So we might receive the funding to do planning 1 year, but we may not get the funding to do the actual construction for several more years. And so that adds on time to projects. So I think if we can, one, get a dedicated source of funding. So in this hypothetical situation, if we get $4.5 billion, you know, the next step in that plan in my mind is being able to utilize either one, increasing the number of folks we have working at the department, or being able to utilize more contracting services to immediately plan out what it would look like to develop all of the lands that are currently in the department's inventory, right? If we could maximize every single unit in our inventory, I mean, if we could maximize every single piece of land that we have that's available for developing homesteading, and we could assess the number of units we get out of that, I think that's the next step towards assessing, okay, well, how much more additional land will we need? In addition to that, you know, infrastructure is a huge challenge, particularly with water. We know that there are homesteads, especially on Molokai, that still have water issues. I think a good amount of resources, time, and energy, not just from this department, needs to be focused on, you know, looking closely at the way water is accounted for in the state and how water is used as a tool in terms of what can and can't be developed. It proves to be a continual obstacle for this department. And I think if we can get basic infrastructure planned out, if we can figure out, you know, what else the department needs in terms of acquisition, then I think it's a matter of plotting out, you know, with this hypothetical instant injection of $4.5 billion. I think it's generating all of these temporary construction jobs that would be generated to get people building homes.
Okay, so we're one of the fundamental background assumptions you're making is that there needs to be a subsidy, some subsidy. Right. So DHHL could act to build unsubsidized homes, right? What would be preventing DHHL from building a substantial amount of homes and then selling them and then recouping their costs from those sales like any other developer?
I mean, I think it's a huge part of keeping the housing affordable, right? I mean, if we don't subsidize it, you know, then we're looking at development costs that are equal to the feasible market. We know that that's not feasible feasible for most people in the state of Hawaii, regardless of ethnicity, but especially for Native Hawaiians. I think the subsidy is important because we know that even with it, there are still many families who cannot attain home ownership even at the prices, right? So, I mean, our homes in Kapolei went for between $300,000 and $500,000. You're not going to get that anywhere in the fee simple market, but there were still families who could not afford that. And I think if we included the subsidy, you are essentially pricing out more Native Hawaiians from being able to attain home ownership out of our program.
Okay. So we have another question in the audience about the affordability of these homes. Can you explain ways to that the department can keep homes affordable, whether it's paying for all the offsite infrastructure, whether it's using non-traditional housing construction techniques such as modular construction, 3D printing, et cetera?
You know, I think I'm fortunate right now to work in an administration that is open to embracing all kinds of ideas. I mean, that is a huge bonus. And I would hope that, you know, we've only got a year and a half left, but I hope future administrations would be open to it. But I don't see one. Yes, we are contemplating modular homes. I think we need to figure out in terms of price, how best that works. And I think there are some wrinkles we want to get out in terms of making sure that, you know, financing options for beneficiaries for those modular homes are completely worked out. In terms of 3D printing, I know that's particularly new technology. I think there are a lot of really, really cool ways to make homes in addition to 3D printing, right? There are recycled materials that make almost these Lego blocks out of recycled materials. I think if we can find a model that works and meets the needs of our beneficiaries, there shouldn't be a reason why we shouldn't at least consider it. And anyone who has ideas like that, if you've got resources available, who you think we should talk to, you know, you can, on our website, dhhl.hawaii.gov, by all means, please reach out, because if there is a feasible option, for example, as this person mentioned, 3D printing, I'd love to look into it and see if it's a reality, if we can make it a reality.
Do you have any thoughts regarding areas of potential cooperation between DHHL and the neighbor island counties?
We work on all islands, and we work with all county leadership. I think that one of the areas that, you know, we're constantly mindful of is existing infrastructure and making sure that our county governments are maintaining them. One of the challenges, I think, is particularly with water and wastewater infrastructure, is the cost it takes to maintain that. I mean, I think our sufficient sums request for infrastructure maintenance, repairs and maintenance, was in excess of $200 million. I think if the counties were willing to come to the table, and I think that there are opportunities. I think working with the counties to make sure that the department isn't unnecessarily taking up utilities when there are agencies who are far more suited and capable of doing it, that would allow us to free up necessary resources and man hours to focus on providing housing. I think that's one area. But again, we actually do have positive relationships with all the neighbor island counties. I think we've worked well with them in terms of addressing some of our needs.
Let's go back to something that you talked about earlier in your presentation, and that's the nature of the waitlist itself. And as you pointed out, almost half of the waitlist has already been offered and turned down homes multiple times. So you know, it the bringing the wait list down to zero, it doesn't seem like a realistic goal just by the nature of the way that wait list is structured. Is that fair to say? I mean, in other words, if I'm a waitlist person, even though I might be a homeowner, I might specifically be waiting for a home that is directly next door to my parents' home, you know, on a specific homestead site in Waimanalo. And so I could be offered homes, you know, 10 times, 100 times, but as long as it's not that specific home, I can just maintain my place on the waitlist forever and just never accept until I get the exact home that I want. Is that fair to say?
I mean, I wouldn't say it's an unrealistic or unattainable goal. I mean, I think, well, actually, I mean, with our current resource structure, the way it is, I mean, it is very close to, I mean, how do you put 182 years into context? How do you tell people who have already been on the waitlist for 50 to 60 years, 40 years, 30 years even, that, you know, we're 182 years away from getting everyone home? So in some ways, I see what you're saying about it being unattainable. But I think with, again, going back to the lack of resources, I think with more resources, we can make a larger dent in the waitlist. And I think that that's the goal, right? I don't think anyone's expecting us to provide 28,000 units overnight. But as going back to that chart, if you look at the way demand for leases and that's reflected in the number of applicants, I mean, it spiked in the 80s. I mean, that's where the department really transitioned away from, you know, where it had been, which is primarily with an agricultural focus. And it was just housing. One thing that I think could come from this discussion is maybe reassessing the way I use the word before, metricize, but how do we measure the department's success? Right now, the department externally, right in the media and by beneficiaries, is assessed on how long the waitlist is. Stories always make a reference to how long folks are on the waitlist. When we go to the legislature for our budget every year, we are questioned about the progress we are making in addressing the waitlist. Everyone frames the discussion in how do we solve the waitlist. I think perhaps with the statistics being that, you know, folks aren't always ready for the home that they're offered, then maybe we should be looking at how many Native Hawaiians we're helping. And that's where I think projects like rentals should be valued much more higher than they are, right? Just because they don't bring somebody off of the waitlist immediately doesn't mean we should discount it. In reality, we're providing people housing. There are people out there who want to rent. They're not interested in home ownership. So I think, I guess where I'm going with this is, I would love to say, you know, you're right, 28,000, that's unattainable. Maybe there's another way to look at it. I just don't know if externally other people are willing to look at us in any other way other than the length of the waitlist and how fast we're addressing it.
Well, to put it another way, if half of the waitlist are already homeowners, they have housing and they are secure in their housing, right? So in that sense, the true level of need of people who are not homeowners is only about half of the 28,000. Isn't that right?
You're about half of the waitlist. Yeah, right. So 48% own homes currently. Yeah. Is that what you're referring to?
Right. And, you know, I don't know if it's the same 48%, but about half of the waitlist has been offered housing multiple times and turned it down. So is that a different way to reframe the waitlist? Non-homeowner waitlist members?
You mean, how are we getting housing to those who don't already own a home? I don't think so. And I mean, here's why. Sure, maybe those families own homes. My guess is the majority of them have owned those homes for more than 10 years, probably more than 20 years, right? They've had the opportunity for home ownership, which is far more attainable, you know, 20 years ago than it is currently, especially for people of, you know, our age. You're in my generation. I think for many of those families, we know that they remain on the wait list because they're looking for a way to create generational housing. And so the house really isn't for them. It's for their, like I said, their children and their grandchildren, which is completely within, you know, what was envisioned the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act. It's a provision of the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act. So they're not doing anything. I mean, they're entitled to pass that home on. And I think, you know, looking only to those who don't own a home ignores the fact that maybe there's a 38% out there who could inherit and could stand to benefit from this program, but can't be on the wait list. I don't think we, under the act, were allowed to necessarily ignore their dad, for example, because he owns a home, knowing that we're skipping their opportunity as well. Does that make sense?
That's fair. But it's kind of an interesting way to frame the whole conversation. You know, I can see what you're saying, I guess. You know, Kamehameha Schools is not judged by how many Native Hawaiians are eligible for its educational services, but that it does not educate. Right. They, you know, they have a mission and they educate only a certain fraction of the Native Hawaiian community, but not the entire Native Hawaiian community. And so you already stated that it's the entire state's responsibility to house every person on the wait list, which is true. But, you know, you can have 50%, you can have 100% Hawaiian ancestry and be happy in a home that is not provided by DHHL and maybe have no intention of moving into a home provided by DHHL.
You might not, right. You might have, but you might have an eligible successor who would. And so I think, you know, we can't deny them that right. It still goes to solving the state's affordable housing crisis, right? The likelihood is that their successor probably is waiting for an affordable housing unit anyway.
So, you know, I think for those of us in this conversation today, the, you know, wait list is a very sympathetic group of people that obviously the state should be working to meet their housing needs with utmost urgency. Politically speaking, what do you think the obstacles have been over the years, over the century, you know, that have prevented DHHL from attaining this goal?
I think a large part of it is politics, right? Like, if we come right out and say, like, the department's never gotten enough funding and that's a huge problem, we have been met many times with those who believe that it's not the funding, it's the leadership. And one, I fundamentally disagree with that because it has been strong Native Hawaiians who have taken up the charge. If this job were easier, you know, I think we'd see more people apply for it. So I think there's sort of like a social and political barrier towards the way people perceive the department. But if we look at the reality, right, we have the benefit of having a library of 100 years of annual reports. Every single annual report going back to 1921 mentions the lack of funding. And it shouldn't be up to the department by itself every year trying to figure out how to come up with funds and how to spend it. I think there were some years where the department was being, I mean, the department got $0 several times in terms of funding. There were years where that happened. And then in addition to getting $0, the department was then told, you're terrible for not getting anything done. It's, you know, for lack of better terms, it's damned if you do, damned if you don't. And so I think a huge part of the problem is this department is politically unpopular. And so people, it's very easy to blame this department. It's very easy to cast it as a scapegoat. It's very easy to cast aside the fact that we're actually the largest affordable housing developer in the state. We've managed to put 10,000 Native Hawaiian families on land that was meant to be second class and third class lands, which was the original designation when the act was passed. We've managed to turn those into homes, and we can always do more. But I think one of the largest barriers is the department has never been able to effectively tell its story and speak to the wins that the department has made, because it is constantly battling a mischaracterization that the department has only been and will always be a string of failures, which is not true. But I think, you know, if I'm waxing poetic right now, I think that's the hugest problem, is that, you know, it's very easy for people to cast this department aside, blame the leadership, say that, you know, nothing's getting done, and use that as a justification for not providing more support. it doesn't make sense to me. It's like, oh, well, you guys are terrible at your jobs. Also, here's, you know, $0 in that those instances where that happened. It's just, it doesn't pencil out. And I think the one benefit, right, it's one thing, I could just complain all day about that, but I think the one benefit of what the department has been trying to do, at least in the last year and a half that I've been here, is, you know, flood people with information. I think people are genuinely interested in what is the department doing. And I think we try to do a better job of communicating, you know, what exactly is going on. And we can always strive to be better. So I don't want to put the image in anyone's mind that we're perfect. You know, none of us are, but I think the more the department can do to let people in and know what's going on, I think what we essentially do is break down this barrier that people have, because I think a lot of people, especially those, I mean, it's not just in the Hawaiian community, right? DHHL sort of sends like a twitch in people's like response, no matter what community you're talking about it in, because it just, it comes with a very long and, you know, in many years, disappointing history.
One feature of Hawaiian Homes lands is that they have 99-year leases on them, which is a policy that is also pursued by other jurisdictions, notably the nation of Singapore, which I've personally visited in order to research their successful housing policies. Now, in Singapore, the government has been very clear in saying that after 99 years, you're out. You get nothing. You walk away with absolutely nothing. In DHHL's context, of course, that's not the case. Can you describe the plan for DHHL for what to do after 99-year leases have expired?
Well, the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act actually allows for an additional 100-year extension. So there are 199-year leases. I mean, in theory, the first homesteads will be coming up on their 100-year anniversary very shortly. And I mean, I can't speak for the commission, but I think I would be surprised if beneficiaries didn't exercise their right to seek an 100-year extension. And I think that, again, without speaking for the commission, because I don't want to say that they're going to grant them all, I think the commission would give very good thought to the fact that, you know, especially right now is not the time to be displacing Hawaiian families. And so, you know, if you're asking me what happens at the end of the 199-year leases, I don't know. I don't have the answers for everything, but I don't know how we approach leases that reach the 199-year mark, because we don't have any, one, we haven't had to get there yet, and two, I don't think there's anything in the Act that tells us what to do when we get there. I imagine it will be, right, that those leases, once they get to the 199-year mark, have had multiple generations of families on them. So there will be a lot of emotion and identity tied to them. So I don't know what the plan is at the end of the 199.
So speaking of the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, if you could wave a magic wand and pass one amendment through Congress and the White House, what would that one amendment be?
I mean, this is me speaking personally. I'm not speaking for the. I'm just going to say me speaking personally. I think the amendment regarding successorship is important, right? There are fewer and fewer 50% Hawaiians. There are fewer and fewer 25% Hawaiians. I think the opportunity to allow for more Hawaiians to qualify, is speaking again, me personally, I think is important. I'm lucky enough, you know, my dad is a qualifying beneficiary. My dad is more than 50% Hawaiian, which makes me qualifying in terms of being able to succeed. But I think we have still a lot of kuleana to those Native Hawaiians who, I mean, blood quantum is just the most divisive thing. I think it's hurtful more than it is helpful. And I think that our community is better than gauging how Hawaiian we are based on this foreign concept of how much blood you have. And I know that there are, in spirit, hundreds of thousands of, you know, part Native Hawaiians who embody it is all that it means to be a Hawaiian, regardless of it. So I know this is getting a little like more philosophical than anything, but I just, you're asking me from a personal level. I think that addressing the blood quantum and bringing down successorship is a start, and that amendment's already been passed, and I think it's waiting. So,
okay, great. Well, we only have a few minutes left, so maybe we'll try to address some of these questions rapidly. First, are there any private developers working with DHHL to make more affordable rentals? Could you describe your current efforts to work with those private developers?
Yes, we are. Stanford Carr is the developer doing the affordable rentals at the former Bowler Drum site. And I think it's a good model. I know we haven't really done a huge foray into it. So I think I don't want to say it's going to be the template, but I think we are open to any other developer coming forward with a project that actually pencils.
Okay. And we also know that your department has an exemption from zoning. So can you describe if there are any adjustments to building and zoning codes to take advantage of non-traditional construction techniques that your department is exploring?
Well, okay. Going back to your question about working with the counties, you know, it's still important for us to maintain good and healthy relationships with the county systems. Flexing with we're exempt from zoning card, I would say is probably not the best like strategic decision, like, right? Because the counties typically have their own, they've got their own sort of parameters that they're working through. So I would say that, you know, loosening the zoning restrictions on, for example, you know, non-traditional housing opportunities can only benefit us, right? I mean, yes, we could probably go in and say we're exempt and we don't have to do that. I don't know if that makes us the best neighbors. So, you know, really any opportunity to amend the zoning code to be more relaxed to allow for more diverse housing options, I mean, we're not going to be opposed to that.
And then speaking of other stakeholders, to what extent have you worked with the labor unions on non-traditional construction methods?
You know, I don't feel totally equipped to answer that question. I do know that we have positive relationships with the union, the labor unions, and I think we strive to continue to maintain those. Whether or not we've approached better ways to utilize those relationships, I can't really speak to them because I haven't, I mean, the last year and a half has been maybe a non-traditional tenure at the department, given everything everyone's going through right now. So, I mean, I don't really know the answers to that question, but what I do know from my limited sort of experience there is that at the very least, we have positive working relationships and we have the support of labor unions very often. And, you know, we strive to support them in providing development opportunities. But beyond that, I'm not really sure.
Okay, great. Well, we're unfortunately at almost an hour here, so I wanted to thank you again, DHHL Deputy Tyler Gomes, for appearing on our webcast today. Thank you for your leadership in the department and for your sincere passion in addressing the housing shortage among the Native Hawaiian community, and I look forward to working with you in the future as well.
Yeah, mahalo for having us. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for joining today. That concludes our presentation, and we look forward to seeing you at our next broadcast of Our Homes Ending the Housing Crisis. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Our Homes Ending the Housing Crisis. And thank you for being part of the solution.